Hello everyone, this is Kumari Bandare from Black and Brown in Bioethics, and you're listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics from marginalized backgrounds to question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and discuss solutions. Today, we're talking about inclusivity in publishing with Dr. Agamoni Ganguly Mitra and Dr. Sabrina Germain. We'll discuss what there is to know about inclusivity in publishing, what barriers currently exist on the global scale, and who can do what to increase chances of publishing. And now to introduce our speakers. Dr. Agamoni Ganguly Mitra, Lecturer and Chancellor's Fellow in Bioethics and Global Health Ethics, and Deputy Director of the J.K. Mason Institute for Medicine. She has a special interest in global bioethics, structural and gender justice. Agamoni has written on ethical issues related to global health emergencies, public health, global surrogacy, sex selection, biomedical research, racism in health, and the concepts of exploitation, vulnerability, and power in bioethics. Our second speaker, Dr. Sabrina Germain, is a reader in healthcare law and policy at the City Law School, City University of London. She is a member of City University's Centre for Healthcare Innovation Research, the University of Sherbrooke Centre for Law and Governance, and the Canadian Research Centre on Law and Health Policy. Sabrina's research interests focus on questions of distributive justice and the role of medical professionals in the healthcare lawmaking process. She is the author of two monographs, the first being Justice and Profit in Healthcare Law, and the second being the co-authored monograph, Medical Doctors and Health Reforms. Currently, she focuses on research projects on inequalities in accessing healthcare services for vulnerable groups and the access to abortion of racially minoritized and gender minority individuals in the UK and in Nepal. Thank you for joining us, both of you. Let's get this show started. There was a tweet that I came across recently on the topic of academic publishing that I have since been wanting to unpack and discuss. And I thought, what better place to do that than here with you two? So let's get down to business. The tweet itself was about a reviewer's comment on a paper that was submitted to a Springer Nature journal. And the comment in question was, begin quote, "I think that to write papers that are competitive, you should probably partner with more experienced authors in the Western world. I understand that that might be difficult or impossible in Saudi Arabia, sorry," end quote. Heavy stuff. So this tweet and the expectedly heated Twitter thread that followed raised a few different issues related to the world of academic publishing. To start with, the publishing world seems to be biased towards high-income countries, and for many major journals, most editorial teams and reviewers are from the Western world. So this might perpetuate narrow ideas of what constitutes good or competitive research. And my question within the context of all of this is, how do you think this creates issues in power dynamics that affect the creation and dissemination of knowledge? Agamoni, would you like to go first?
Thank you very much. There are several layers, of course, to both the tweet and also to the question that you've given us. We'll explore this again and again, I think, throughout the conversation. But I think to get us started, this very well illustrates this idea that expertise and knowledge is the purview of the West. And it really hints at the much bigger issue about coloniality in knowledge production and creation. This idea that knowledge is created and disseminated from the West and is to be consumed by the rest of the world. And maybe that way they'll be able to pull themselves up from a dark hole of ignorance or something along those lines, right? However, having said that, and I don't want my next comment to sort of take away from what I just said, but I think academic publishing, scholarly publishing, has its own language and academic styles and skills, again, which is not the purview of Western or Global North academics. but it's something that we have had access to, that we've been trained in, and that we've had lots of opportunities to sort of try and fail and to be nurtured and supported by others who've had the resources to hone those skills, right? So even coming from one discipline to the other, you'll find that there are very different styles and expectations about how we write in academia, and it's its own language. So it is not just a question of experience and expertise, it's a question of learning the kind of styles that are expected in certain kind of context. So just to get us started, I think that's my initial response to that tweet and your question.
Thank you for that. Sabrina, would you like to respond to what Agamoni shared and to the question in general?
Yes, absolutely. I think Agamoni is making very good, solid points about the colonialist kind of aspect of the question. I think this is very interesting, a question, because this is something that is rarely openly discussed. And I think that more honesty and transparency towards these dynamics should be brought to the fore. Producing output of a great quality is only kind of a small part of what publishing is, in my opinion. There's various layers, as I highlighted in the conversation. I think we can substantially contribute to academic research, whether or not we can get published or not. But the creation and dissemination of knowledge dimension that you highlight in the question here is very problematic, because this is the type of discourse from members of editorial boards that shows obviously prejudice and bias. I think it's even more problematic because it does skew the metrics towards high-income country researcher, but also it has the unfortunate and very serious consequence of stifling the knowledge production and the knowledge sharing of creative research from low-income countries. And we will see them being often turned down from some journals. And also, journals have reputations very pragmatically, and researchers talk among themselves. So it's easy to imagine many researchers from low global South countries, low income countries, being put off from submitting in a certain type of publication. So this impacts us all. It doesn't help to improve the quality of our knowledge. It shows narrow-mindedness and it fosters bias. And it also constructs an incomplete picture on some very important issues. So there is very strong structural and negative power dynamics at play, because journals based in high-income countries also have a greater impact factor. And high-income countries researcher will be more quickly established as expert if they tend to publish more in those journals. So this means that it is more likely that when it comes to editorial board members, they will see high-income countries' colleagues as more apt to publish, and therefore they will progress altogether their careers faster. So there's a lot of underlying current in this as well.
Yes, and if I can just almost emphasize something that Sabrina said, which I think is at the core of what we'd want to get at, is that this is a loss for everyone concerned. Right? This is a very much loss for global knowledge production and access. If we're not hearing all the voices, we're not getting a good picture of what knowledge creation is and where knowledge is, what different perspectives are that we're missing if we're not allowing the platform to be accessible and open to every voice that needs to be there. So it's very much a loss for global academia.
I'm loving the variety of points both of you have touched on, and would like to get more into that as the conversation progresses. As the next step, though, going back to the tweet, that tweet inspired others to share similar horror stories. One Twitter user shared a comment made by a reviewer of a prominent Anglo-American journal, and the comment said, "We are sorry, but the geographic scope of your research, meaning the country you're doing your research, is not of interest to our readership." Now, while there is an argument to be made for journals with a specific geographical focus not being interested in articles focusing on other geographies, if the journal is not geography specific, this comment is clearly discriminatory. And it touches on a well-recognized pattern of higher numbers of publications from high-income countries compared to low-income countries, which we already recognized in this space. And I wanted to hear your perspectives on how we can overcome such discriminatory gatekeeping and work towards more geographical representation in scholarly publishing. For instance, how do we broaden the topical and geographical interests of a readership? Because that comment highlights that the power also rests with the leadership and not just with the editorial boards, which what we first highlighted.
Yes. Well, I think it starts with greater diversity on editorial boards or commissioning committees. But for editorial boards to become more diverse, there needs to be publishing from various geographical areas and more diverse research. So it becomes harder for researchers from the Global South to become members of editorial boards if they cannot get their papers published in that journal, because obviously this is kind of a circular phenomenon. So it comes down to publication and resources that are needed to produce articles, in my opinion. So we need to have less bias about the decisions of who is acting as a peer reviewer and who we invite to co-author articles, books, or when we're inviting people on projects as edited collections, for example. There's outstanding scholarship and research produced in Global South countries. And of course, we should be acknowledging that and valuing that. But we need to be more intentional and mindful in how we do this, especially when we review these authors. We need peer reviewers that have more inclusive mindsets, in my opinion. And we need for them to hold the appropriate expertise on a topic or a geography. And we have to have them offer a non-biased and fair assessment of the work. And this is not always the case, unfortunately, because of a lack of diversity on those boards. So members of the board need to have also connections with these other geographies and these other areas of expertise, and they need to cultivate them. And that requires effort, because we have to see them being included and to see these areas of specialty being included in the purview of the journal and what they're looking after. So it's not for them to really decide what the readership wants, although they do believe they are the gatekeepers, but they should be a bit more open-minded of what they're looking at. As I said, it's a very circular phenomenon, in my opinion. Agamoni, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but that's my feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. I very much echo a lot of what you said. I think, of course, that the idea of the geographical scope is almost, of course, I don't know the background of that tweet at all. I don't know what kind of journal it was and what they were suggesting to publish. But, you know, unless you're trying to submit a piece to the Journal of South Asian Studies and it's a piece on Iceland and it's got no connection, again, I think that that kind of comment really embodies that neocolonial idea of where knowledge production lies and what is of interest to certain readers and so on. And I think there's so much to unpack there, and preferably also written in English and so on. As Sabrina said, better geographical representation on editorial boards is absolutely key. But I think we need to also go a little bit further upstream in thinking about funding and funders and where the money goes to actually have the research done. Those of us who have the time and the space to do research is also because we are funded in some way or the other to do the research, right? And so you need, in order to have better power dynamics, you need the money to be flowing in contexts where then people are given the time and the spaces and the resources required to do the research that will be published. The work of editors, I think, is absolutely key. And you've said much of what I had in mind as well, Sabrina. There's definitely needs to be an active re-education of targeting other kinds of research, other kinds of geographies. And it's difficult because also most of the editors who are also academics are doing this in their extra time, of which they have none. And they're doing this for free. And they're, you know, there's all this labor going into a huge machinery that's making a lot of money, but where nobody else is really supported to do this work. So I recognize in saying this, we're expecting editors to do more work than they have so far. But I think it's absolutely key if we're going to increase our geographical representation, our readership, and so on. It's a difficult task, but we have to do this through encouraging publication, through encouraging, as you said, collaboration, co-authoring, and so on. But also, there is something very key to remember, that we shouldn't fall back on this idea that, you know, here are the top journals, and of course, they're based in the Global North. Right. There was a recent paper, I think it was commented paper, which the title was "The Knowledge from the Global South is in the Global South." Right. So it is also recreating that kind of power dynamics between the Global North and the Global South to say, here, we're opening up this platform to you. Why don't you come and publish with us? We're giving you this fantastic platform. We have to take a step back and to be humble and say, actually, we should be going out and reading other things that are published in other journals, in journals that would otherwise not be reading because we're based in the Global North and so on. So we have to also go look for the knowledge, for the research and the writing that's maybe not appearing in our journals and not written in English as well.
I think if I can, I'd like to pick up on that last few points. I think you're making such important comments around the elite nature of academia. Of course, this is inherent to what we do. We always look at ranking and which one is the top journal we want to publish in. We need to be very mindful. So there's the aspect as well of your, as you highlighted, of the fact that this is not something that is free labor, essentially. So we cannot expect, of course, all editorial board members to having all-encompassing knowledge of other people's areas or geography. However, we should be very mindful and intentional, maybe looking outside the box and the top ranking journal. So in various forums, not just with regards to what we want to achieve individually as scholars, but how we view our colleagues as well and what they've achieved. So it's how we measure excellence and research excellence. And I know we're going to most probably be talking about this a little further down the line, but I think it's about checking our biases, all of us in this academic space.
I actually have a follow-up question on everything that you just shared. How do you think that journals and editorial boards can be held accountable in terms of implementing some of the measures that you mentioned?
Very tough question. I think some editorial boards are trying to make an effort, but I think it's still very slow. And I think, I mean, to go back to a point that I made earlier, I think a lot more resources need to go into supporting editorial boards into making these changes. Right now, it's a couple of academics who are sort of the main editors who then, you know, have an editorial board, but are very much dependent on everybody's goodwill and volunteer work. And I think if we don't have more resources, it is virtually impossible to ask then thinly spread academics to make even more time to make sure that we're doing the right thing. Even if we do want to be doing the right thing, I think we need the time and resources to do that. I think one step would be to support editorial boards better in terms of infrastructure, in terms of time and help to do this work.
Yeah, I think resources are key, but I see in recent weeks, years, some editorial boards putting out calls and very intentionally seeking diversity on their boards, being diversity not just with regards to geographies or ethnicity, but also with regards to career levels. So we always thought this was kind of, you know, the remit of high level, highly intellectual professors to be on editorial boards. But there is really an opening up to early career researchers. I can even think of some top journals that are doing that at the moment, where they understand that the fresh blood and new ideas from early career researchers is invaluable and therefore should be sought after. And I think this brings in hopefully some diversity of thought on board and some sense of legitimacy in a way. So hopefully accountability will be hard, I think, because this is unfortunately still a very arbitrary arena. But I think that there's hope out there of wanting to change things for sure.
That's good to hear that there is hope and that change is happening, though a bit too slowly, perhaps, for what we would like to see. And I would actually like to go back now to something, Agamon, you mentioned at the very beginning regarding different languages that we see used in journal writing or in publishing journals and the different resources and training that is required to do that kind of writing. And so with that in mind, what might be some obstacles that are currently in place when thinking about making publishing more accessible to academics from diverse backgrounds and levels of familiarity with languages in which journals publish?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting you talk of obstacles. I'd like to turn the question on its head, really, and say, what are the ways in which we're gatekeeping these spaces, right? So instead of thinking about obstacles, what are the ways in which we need to make sure that we're not doing business as usual, because it's clearly not working in terms of thinking about diversity in the broad sense. And I think the first thing, and I'd be quite interested in hearing what Sabrina has to say about this, is that I think, quite ironically, in a podcast about publishing, I think publishing in a way is a problem, in that publishing, especially in these sort of high impact journals, these prestige journals, is still one of the biggest markers of success. Instead of thinking about all the ways in which we're academics and that we're creating knowledge, that we're teaching, that we're nurturing, that we're supervising, that we're supporting others to advance in their careers, where you're published still is a very big marker of how well you're doing as an academic. And I think that kind of culture change is a very long process, but I think it's absolutely necessary in order to sort of kind of break the cycle of having to always publish in the spaces and then coming up to these same obstacles again and again. And associated with that is this idea, although I think, at least in my institution, and I see this elsewhere as well, there is a slight change of culture around this idea that you have to publish a lot. Again, if you've published a lot in high impact journals, you're seen as this, you know, star academic and so on. And that really forces a lot of people to publish all the time. And it makes space for things like predatory journals and so on. And then, you know, you lose track of what's going on even in your field because there is so much happening and hardly a day goes by without some predatory journals, you know, sending you emails asking you to publish in their journals and so on. So I think there's something at the core of publishing and how that relates to an academic's worth is something that we need to question and is very problematic. On the question of language, I think the predominance of English is really, again, problematic, and it's colonial, of course. But it also means that we're not accessing a wider knowledge spectrum, because, of course, there's knowledge produced in other language, but there's also concepts produced in other language that can't possibly be translated in English either, right? So there is all sorts of things going on where we're sort of really speaking within our quite big, but still within our bubble in this echo chamber of thinking we've sorted it all out in our heads, but we're bound to miss out on really important ideas and concepts if we think publishing and writing in English is the only kind of knowledge we should be accessing. So for example, just of course, scholarly publishing is still incredibly inaccessible. It's quite elitist, it's quite colonial, it's quite ableist as well in the way we use language in order to produce and to present knowledge. And that's, I think, really problematic. In one of a recent project I was part of, we tried to set up a website with some case scenarios about humanitarian research and health, where we had some scenarios about epistemic injustice and the question of language in humanitarian work. And there, what we tried to do, again, we ran out of resources, so we couldn't do that many, but we tried to translate these in Creole, for example, where we tried to at least signal that it is important to have knowledge produced and disseminated in languages beyond English. So there are little things that we can do, but there are also bigger questions that we need to really, you know, stop and think about what we want to be doing as academics and how we want to be creating the idea of a good academic.
Absolutely. And I think it also connects back to readership, because once again, if most of the writing is in English, are we assuming that the audience or readership we want to communicate and engage with is composed of English speakers and readers?
This strangely made me think of just an anecdote. I was having a chat with a colleague that was coming back from conference, and they said, oh, it's such a great, I was on European law, wasn't part of the conference. And they said, this is interesting. There were so many people sharing papers. And then I realized there's a world out there that doesn't publish in English. And this is not to speak to global South countries. This is to speak about France. And somebody mentioned, oh, do you know this publication, which is a very, very famous publication in France. And I thought, this is quite funny how opaque and kind of contained are our boundaries of knowledge as well, which also speaks to the very problematic nature of publishing. So, of course, when we're in English speaking world, we do believe that it travels so far and, you know, well, as far as other people want to read our research. I mean, I guess so far as we have such a small community as academics, we believe we travel those frontiers and everybody's aware of our research. Certainly not. We're a very close group of very small individual interested in one very small field. But I thought it's even worse than we think, because we're so unaware of what else is around. And that's a real shame. I can think of a few obstacles as well, not only to Hegemony's points, which I think are extremely valid. I can think of a few other ones, having experienced them myself, not because of geography per se with regards to my research, but because of the place where I work, because I'm not from the UK. And so I don't have the network that UK academic would have, for example. I'm Canadian. So I think that I found myself, especially as a woman of color, looking at issues around women of color in my research, I found that it was harder for me to get my foot in the door of some journals. And it comes down, of course, to peers and peer reviewing of someone's work in a new arena, in a new country. But also it's the relationship that publishing has with networking itself, because it's much down to the networking with regards to publishers, editors, and who you know on editorial boards. And nobody wants to talk about this openly. It's all about very strict peer reviewing. It's all about, you know, the greatest knowledge and excellence. It's not about relationships. But we all uncover bit by bit as we become more senior that there's a lot to do with kind of a human aspect to publishing. And I think what we found is that specialist journals we can get into with a particular research that we would have because they're interested in more interdisciplinary work or they're interested in other geographies, especially on special issues, for example. But with regards to generalists, top generalist journals, they're extremely hard to get into. And this is for the good reason because there's more competition, obviously, for those top journals. But as I said, this is problematic because they're ranked higher because they have a higher impact factor and they have a wider readership. So the recognition of one's work and expertise is confined to specific journals, but also confined to a certain ranking in a way. So what I would list, if I can do my laundry list of obstacles, I would say, well, there's, of course, a lack of diversity in editorial board and publishing house committee. I'd say there's a lack of diversity on the peer reviewers, book proposal or articles. There's weaker network with regards to foreign authors that creates an indirect barrier for them. There's a lack of resources that we've highlighted time and time again, and this is very right with regards to institution who employ us, and we might be very fortunate, as I am, to be very well supported, to go to conferences, for example, but others are not as fortunate. And also, they don't have access to peer reviewers before submitting their work, which is also very problematic. And this is something that we need. We need a support system prior to submission. So these would be my laundry list of horrible things that would prevent good publications.
Thanks for that, Sabrina. And actually, I think you also touched on a very important point about the importance of networks, human connections, and the behind-the-scenes work that happens when it comes to publishing. And actually, even when it comes to the writing process itself, for instance, chances of publishing are also affected by access to opportunities to attend conferences and build these sorts of collaborations that could lead to co-authored papers, which in turn might eventually lead to papers that you lead. When thinking about publishing, how do you level the playing field so that those who are not able to access such opportunities are not necessarily negatively impacted? And what can individual academics themselves do to increase their chances of building collaborations that are helpful in publishing?
I think it's quite connected to Sabrina's earlier response. Like yourself, Sabrina, I'm not from the UK and I was mostly not trained in the UK either. So I find it quite difficult to actually know who is who in the field when I got to the UK. I have some big names, but that said, I don't know some of my peers. I don't know who is sort of up and coming and so on. So even I, with so much resource and so much privilege, find it difficult. So I can just about imagine what it's like to be an early career researcher, to be a person of color, to be a woman of color in this context. It's a staggering amount of challenge. And I think, as you said, networking and connection is absolutely key here. Even if we think that all it takes is good peer review, good anonymous peer review, it's not just that, right? Because where you go to conferences, who you're going to be connected to depends on who you know. And it depends on whether you've had the right kind of supervisors and mentors and who they're connected to, right? So you're going to meet the people that your supervisors and mentors are connected to, and then you get invited to do a co-authored edited chapter in an edited volume, for example, and that's how you get a foot in the door and so on and so forth. So all of us who've managed to get somewhere in academia had a lot of those kind of often invisible support that you get. And I think in thinking about how to level the playing field, I mean, there's such a huge amount of work to do there. I wouldn't even know where to start. But one thing to think about, especially in conferences that take place in the global north, as many of them do, is to think about things like conference fees, but also things like visas, right? So one of the biggest issues that we find in international, so-called top international conferences in our field is that a lot of people can't come because there's no chance for them to get a visa or to get a visa in time. So if we are serious about this, we really need to rethink the format of our conferences and think about whether we want to do many more online conferences, for example. And a lot of people are reluctant because they really like meeting people in person and doing those kinds of networking. And I understand that. But at the same time, that's just gatekeeping and keeping our privilege to ourselves, really. also to make an effort, just like with editorial boards, to have much more diverse panels, not just in terms of, you know, things like gender and race, but also things of thinking of disability and so on, and class, and all sorts of other factors that is going to become an obstacle for a researcher. And also, it shouldn't just be the responsibility of minoritized scholars, for example, to make sure they put themselves out there, right? So I was in a panel on, again, on writing for early career researchers. And one of the things I said, and it exactly goes back to what you said, Sabrina, about this idea that you just send it somewhere to the ether, and somehow the magic of peer review happens and you get published. And the reality is just so different, right? And I said to them, if there are special issues, go for them, because that's one of those less opaque and more transparent spaces where you actually can get in touch with the guest editors and say, I'm thinking about writing on this. What do you think? I recently was part of a guest edited a special issue, and we very much encouraged those who were submitting to get in touch because we wanted to really encourage more diversity. It was, in the end, much, much harder than we had imagined. And actually, I don't even think that we did such a great job in the end, but it was just so difficult, even though we tried. But at least with special issues, you can have that conversation, you can make those connections. And then, of course, articles still get sent to peer reviews and might still not make it to the special issue. And so what I was saying about this idea of, you know, what minoritized researchers as individuals can do, it's hard to say, put yourself out there, make connections, because I can't promise mm-hmm. that they're not going to be met with condescension and ignorance and just discrimination. So it's a very difficult thing to say to people to just, oh, just go out there and just, you know, strike up a conversation. I've never gone to a conference and had a conversation with somebody I had not known before, right? This is just not my personality. I don't come into a room and wield that kind of authority. I hate drinks reception because I'm so short compared to everybody else. I feel like I'm, you know, having to look up around the room at all these men wearing suits and really, really tall. And then I just feel like I need to crawl into my hotel room and cry, because it is just not a space that's made for me. There's only so much individuals can do. And it's definitely on us as Global North academics, especially as we gain more power and privilege, to make sure that these inclusions are much more intentional and systematic, rather than just saying, we have made the space, here's an open space, come if you will, and do the best you can do. I think that's just not good enough.
I couldn't agree more. I think a lot of things that you've said echo with me, not just for the fact that I'm also extremely short and feel very awkward in those spaces, but I think that the onus should not be on those scholars. We should be, I'll say it time and time again, we should be more intentional in who we pick as peer reviewers. If you are on an editorial board, you should really think about who you're asking and how you think they might receive a piece, because a lot of it is very subjective and it is not necessarily speaking to the quality of the piece, but more how it lands with a colleague because of their theoretical approach or their own work. So we all have bias, and it's natural, we're humans, but we have to be very mindful of that. I think it's particularly difficult, as you said, for early career researchers. And I think very practically with regards to conferences, if you do have a relationship with a publishing house, for example, and you are chatting at the stand, just make an effort, be intentional. It was a conference last April, and I made a conscious effort to bring in someone and introduce them to a colleague. But also I thought maybe I should introduce them to the publisher, because I published an edited collection not so long ago, and then maybe they would be interested in knowing what their work is. Establishing those very small human connections, if you can, it's incremental and it's really important, and it will build up somebody's career in the end. So I think it's all about paying forward what we have had. It's all about, as you said, being aware of our privilege and then really kind of doing the work to not necessarily mentor junior colleagues, but at least link them up. For more senior colleagues, we should be very mindful of how we receive their work when we are peer reviewers, because we are asked often to peer review other people's work. So I would say that these are the two elements that really stand out for me.
Thank you both for articulating so beautifully the responsibility, or might I even say the obligation, that we as scholars in the global north have in terms of sharing our privilege and opening up that space and being more intentional in making the space more accessible and open to people from different backgrounds from all over the world. And I would actually like to build on the topic of minoritized academic and the burdens that come with it, because often those who write about intersectional political issues such as race are marginalized from more canonical discussions that sideline such issues. Bianca Williams actually wrote in 2022, the commitment that many Black women anthropologists show to interdisciplinary, community-based, anti-racist and feminist work further marginalizes them both in the anthropological canon and in other institutional practices. That's a direct quote from her. And it really captures that what we all know, which is that very explicit political intersectional academic work is often undertaken by academics from various minoritized backgrounds. And so how can such academics continue to write about these causes that they care about without being sidelined from the canonical discussions?
So I will say something that will be unpopular, but I will say never stop writing if you can. So there's really a conditional and here, and we're speaking to the point we've been making time and time again, if you have the support of your institution. But because for good writing to happen, you need to be able to take sabbatical leave, you need to have funds to go to conferences, you need to be supported to write grant applications. So you should write if you can write, because all writing leads to collaboration, publication, engagement. So I would also say engage in the dialogue with a broader supportive community. And I think it's really important to do that. I found a lot of comfort myself sharing my experience with other women of color in the same arena, and the advice that they've given me and the help and support that they continue to give me. And I think there's so much strength in solidarity. So I would encourage marginalized scholars to join established also associations. And they might seem very daunting and intimidating, but they are very supportive networks. I joined myself the Sociolegal Studies Association Board of Trustees 3 years ago, and I found a wonderful network of support there. I'm also part of the Sociolegal Scholars Help Law section, and this helped me establish some interesting connections as well. So I think we don't want to be sidelined. And so we need to maybe go to other avenues. The podcasting is great, poster presentations for more junior colleagues, or engaging even in legal designs, kind of alternative ways of sharing our knowledge and presenting our work at conferences, if possible. Special issues, as we've highlighted, are great avenues. And to continue sharing our experiences, not just with our network of support, but also some allies that we think can break down those barriers and those canonical discussions. There's a strong group right now around me that's very keen to open doors. And I found a lot of strength in that. They bring me into strategic conversations. And I feel very lucky that I have these people that are willing to have an open dialogue around these issues, because this is not something that everybody wants to do. And we have to be able to bear the discomfort to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you give so many really important practical advice as well, Sabrina. I think that's really, really useful. I think a few things come to mind. One is that I think this idea of creating community or finding community is so important. I think the only way to survive in academia, perhaps in other sectors as well, but definitely in academia, is to try and find your community of people. And sometimes it is within your own team, you've got good mentors and so on. Sometimes it's a combination. You'll find support elsewhere in the institution. You might find support outside the institution, but wherever there is support, don't hesitate to take that support. Because one thing that comes with also, you know, this idea of being sidelined is really interesting, because as minoritized scholars, we find ourselves being both slightly invisible, but also slightly hypervisible. Right. So you get asked to be on every panel and on every task force and on every, and there's a burden that comes with that representation, and it takes a toll. And it means we're spending a lot of hours doing this kind of work when others are publishing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be really aware of that. And I don't know that I have a good answer for this about how to take care of yourself in this context, but we just have to be aware that suddenly we become this expert through a sheer positionality, and then we get asked to take on all these extra burdens. For early career researchers, I think there's something to say about being slightly strategic as well, right? So wherever there's an opportunity to work with a more senior scholar, for example, who is already quite established in those topics that you're interested in, I think definitely take the opportunity to do that. Co-author with your peers as well. I think that's really important. And even if you get rejections, I think we shouldn't be too discouraged in sending the kinds of things we write about into sort of the mainstream discourse and the mainstream sort of publishing context. But I think, again, I think the most important thing I want to say here is that the canon absolutely must change, right? It is not good enough to say, here's the canon and here are all the things in the periphery that we're really interested in. Because as Charles Mills has said, these are the things that we should really be caring about. We should be looking at the world not from the veil of ignorance. We should be looking at the world from the perspective of inequality, of a disadvantage, of all sorts of injustices. That's where we should start from. So again, the canon is not doing well enough. It's not doing its job. And again, those of us slowly, when we get to the position where we have the privilege, where we have those discussions, where we are invited to have those discussions, there's definitely an onus on us to make sure that those canons starts to look very different from what it has so far.
Yes, the canon definitely has to change, as we have been discussing within the context of publishing for most of this conversation. I also just want to say that the two of you have been sharing some wonderful wisdom. It's been gold, and I've been taking mental notes and actual notes. This is great stuff. So before we move on to the very last bit of today's conversation, I also wanted to open the floor to see whether you two had any questions for each other.
Yes, well, I would like to go first, if that's okay. I have certainly a question for Agamoni, because I'm a huge fan of her work. And I wanted to know, I'm curious, like that, who are the people that you've relied on with regards to acting as sounding boards for the peer review of your own research outputs? If you have a group that you rely on, what are your tricks? Who are your people?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think it depends on what I'm working on. So there will be a handful of trusted colleagues whom I call friends, really. They're more friends than colleagues, who unfortunately pretty much have to read everything that I write. Because I don't quite trust myself to send it anywhere before they've had, you know, a look. However, again, depending on what I'm writing on, sometimes I might send a paper to, say, a scholar who's a sociologist, with the caveat that this is a paper that I'm writing in bioethics. However, you know, it makes use of the sociological concept. Can you have a quick look and see whether you think what I'm saying is right, or at least not terribly wrong, and so on. So over the years, I've gotten less, I don't want to say precious, I was never quite precious about my work, but definitely feel less vulnerable about sending things out and asking for trusted, constructive comments. I think that's always been very useful. But again, yes, there are a couple of people around me that I just stop in the corridor and say, you need to be reading this before I can send it off, please. How about you? Do you have your own community of people?
Yeah, I think I'm the same. And I think it's really interesting what you say about vulnerability around peer review. I used to take it very personally to begin with. So I had a hard time putting myself out there. But then I found a lot of strength in the peer review, even the more drastic kind of violent peer reviews. Some friends, I don't know if I still call them friends, they are friends and colleagues. And I actually try to lean on a lot of my friends that are also law academics, but they're outside the medical law field. So they're less acquainted to some of the jargon sometimes, but they have very insightful comments from a more general perspective, because we all kind of take for granted that everybody understands what we're talking about, but that's not the case at all. So I tend to do that. I like also to have the perspective of scholars that are outside the discipline. And unfortunately, I do bore even my family with my academic work. My husband has been a very strong peer reviewer of my first monograph for him. He suffered a lot through it, but it was worth it. I mean, not only telling me that he did not understand certain concepts, but also the typos and all that stuff. And all these things, although they seem very minor, are quite important before submitting to a journal. So you learn that the hard way. But I thought it was quite a more friendly reviewer to begin with, and then going off to a more academic reviewer is always a smoother ride for me, at least.
I also must say, with people I trust and are close to me, I will often discuss an idea even before I've finished my first draft or when I'm thinking of writing the first draft. And I say, this is what's sort of going on in my head. What do you think about it? Does it make sense to you? And so on. But with very trusted people, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel bad for my friends and family that I'm going to be approaching after this conversation with the drafts and drafts of my writing. Great. To now come back and wrap up the conversation about publishing that we've been having, I'd like to ask the two of you whether you have ever received any discriminatory comments or whether someone you know has received any discriminatory comments from reviewers and what advice you have for scholars who do.
Well, this is a sensitive one, I would say, but I will say that I co-edited the collection with my colleague, Dr. Adrienne Yon, who's absolutely wonderful. She's also at City. So now might as well plug the book, so I'll plug it. We wrote a book called Beyond the Virus, Multidisciplinary and International Perspective on Inequality Raised by COVID-19. It's not just about the plug. It's also to explain what happened at the proposal stage. So we were meant, of course, to address the comments of our peer reviewers, and they were really good and they made very good suggestions. And we really took the time to address them because they took the time to understand our project. So it's a book around inequalities raised by the pandemic. And we wanted to do this from a perspective of a diverse group of scholars from around the world, various disciplines and career levels, and of course, ethnicity. So we wanted to be inclusive across the board. And we thought this transpired very much as an element of our proposal. So we have had three reviewers. The third one didn't seem to be fully on board with that idea. But in fairness, there were valid kind of criticisms that came out from that third review. But this person also bluntly suggested that we get rid of two contributors. And it did not speak directly to the issues of geography, but they were suggesting getting rid of two women of color, and I quote, because their subject were simply not a good fit. And so for us, we were very astonished because these particular contributors were offering an intersectional critical analysis in their respective field. So we thought this really spoke to a lack of open-mindedness, and we decided to include them because their perspective were important anyways. But we thought this is not an innocent suggestion on the part of the reviewer, because we thought both of these abstracts were actually the strongest of all the contributions that we had received. So it's not openly discriminatory, it's not prejudice, but it speaks the underlying nature of this issue in academia, the structural issues of what we view as excellent. We could even extend this conversation to the ref, we won't go there, but what do we view as excellence in this field or in law or in academia in general is quite problematic, as we've highlighted so far. So it speaks to a very classic view of the academic in their ivory tower and not really looking at other disciplines and dialogue and perspectives. So that's the example I wanted to share.
I think that's such a important and interesting anecdote, because again, I haven't faced any direct discriminatory comments, but I hear this all the time about people who propose books. This is not quite the right time. You're not quite the right person to be doing this. Those kinds of responses that are very common. And this really speaks to the importance, both in terms of books, but also in journal editorials, to have a strong set of editors who really understand what they're doing. Because ultimately, you are going to get peer reviews that are not great. And you have to have the knowledge and the strength to make those decisions to say, no, actually, those comments are problematic, or we're just going to disregard those comments, or we're going to make those decisions. Because sometimes I think editors should even take a step and say, actually, those reviewers' comments you can disregard, or we're not even going to put them in your review because they're just clearly, they don't know what they're talking about, and they're clearly being biased and prejudiced, and you shouldn't have to read them at all.
And can I ask whether in instances like that, it's possible to give feedback to the reviewers themselves and to perhaps find ways to ensure that they will not continue to act in similar ways moving forward?
So we didn't feel like we were in a position to tell off the reviewer, but we certainly made the point that when we restructured the book and the outline, because that reviewer also made very valid comments around the structure of the book and the way it was flowing. But when we restructured and re-outlined the book, we made sure that these contributions were very much highlighted as being included. So we responded saying they actually some of the strongest one, and they are important because of these reasons. So we had outlined why each chapter was essential for us, But we reinforce the importance of these particular contributions because they were essentially really one of the strongest ones. Well, we were really lucky to have those contributors come forward to offer chapters.
It just shows how much you can do by using your power as an editor or as being part of the editorial board. And it was quite uplifting, Sabrina, to hear how you handled that situation. So thank you for giving us that hope and example of how one must proceed in situations like that. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being a part of this podcast and for sharing all your wisdom and experience with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us. It's been really interesting and a lot of fun. And I've learned so much from your perspective, Sabrina, as well. Thank you for your time.
The same for me. It was such a pleasure to have this conversation with you both. Thank you so much for having us.
In today's podcast about inclusivity in publishing, we talked about a range of different topics. We touched on power dynamics involved in knowledge dissemination in academia, structural barriers that exist when thinking about inclusivity in publishing, the behind-the-scenes work and networking that go into publishing, kinds of discrimination in the publishing world, the importance of different forms of community and structural support in going through the publishing journey, and action points for changing the publishing game for the better. Coming out of this conversation, I am mindful of how important it is to be kind to ourselves when trying to publish work, because we are working with a rigged system. I am also trying to further my thinking in terms of the different ways in which we can all support ourselves, each other, and marginalized academics and topics to change the status quo. Thanks for listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrownbioethics.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts, follow our work, and connect with our network.